The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone. And last week, I talked about letting go. And one of the points that I tried to make is that sooner or later, anybody, everyone, is going to have to learn how to let go. You might not have to do it today or tomorrow, but sooner or later, you will. And to grow up, to mature, to be wise, involves in part learning how to let go well, how to let go wisely. So this evening, I would like to follow up that talk with two different aspects of letting go, or two different perspectives that I have for it and how I practice with it. And one has to do with turning towards the clinging, turning towards the way we hold on, and being present for that. And the other is the wonderful world of the heart or the mind when it has let go, or when it's not clinging, and to have a sense of that, to feel for that, to recognize that, and practice with that. So, letting go. And of course, there's many things we need to pick up, be involved in, be engaged in, be concerned with. And I came across this poem that a friend of mine had written a long time ago today. Wendy Lewis wrote, "It's like this. There's this bird, and you catch it in your hands. You feel its softness, warmth, its heart rapidly beating. But if you keep holding it, it's no longer a bird. So you open your hands, catch it, and let it go again and again." So the bird here symbolizes our life or things we run into in our life, that there are many times we have to pick things up and hold things, and we hold them carefully, like we'd hold a bird that we somehow catch. I don't know if it's the right, best analogy, but you hold it carefully, lightly. You don't want to squeeze it too hard. Maybe there's a short period of time you get to hold it, and then you also have to let it go, because if you keep holding on the life of whatever you're clinging to, something about it gets squished, gets squashed, gets destroyed. And so to release, give back its freedom, give back its life to our life, is part of the movement of letting go. But it's not easy sometimes. Sometimes it's quite hard. But sooner or later, people who do mindfulness practice have to address this issue of how we hold on, how we cling, how we grasp at things, how we resist, how we contract. Because when you practice mindfulness, sooner or later, you will take responsibility for your contribution. You take responsibility for what you do. There's something about, as mindfulness matures, that people become less and less inclined to blame other people, to blame others for what you feel, to blame others for what you hold on to blame others for what you're preoccupied and caught with in your mind. Because as you become more mindful, we see that the caughtness, the holding on, the clinging, the resistance is something that we do. Someone might have done something terrible to you or something wonderful to you, and you could be caught clinging to your resentment and your anger, or clinging to your desire and your wish. And it's nothing to do with that person. The cause of your clinging, your resistance, is not the person, but rather what you do inside of you, yourself, in relationship to what that person has done. And that's a huge leap for people to make, to see that, because there's such a strong tendency to project outwards and to blame and to want and to put our wishes for our aspiration, our wishes for our well-being into the future, into other people, into things. And so we cling. and we don't let go. So to take responsibility and in mindfulness, what we do is we turn around and we look, turn and lean into our clinging. If you can let go easily, sometimes that's wise to do. But really what you want to do in Buddhist spirituality, the way that I understand what the Buddha was teaching, is you don't turn away from anything. You don't turn away from your struggles. You don't turn away from your difficulties. You don't turn away from how you're feeling. You don't turn away from your clinging. But you turn into it. You turn into it and you're present for it to see it and learn for it. Because a huge part of wisdom is to understand really well the problem, rather than understanding the answer. Or you can't really understand maybe the answer is to understand the problem. And so we turn towards it to be present, to see. But not to understand necessarily with words that can explain what it was all about, but to bring our attention and really feel it and be present. One of the characteristics of clinging is oftentimes when we cling, we're separate from ourselves. The more you cling, the more a person clings, the more the person has really lost touch with themselves, even though they might feel lousy and terrible, because clinging involves usually a preoccupation with something that's not in intimacy with oneself. And so when we turn towards clinging, it's really to turn towards ourselves and come home to here, find out what's here. And one of the most useful things that I know what to do when I'm caught in something and clinging and can't let go of it easily, I have strong feelings that are going on or something, is not to spend a lot of time thinking about it, but to spend a lot of time feeling it. So turn towards it and let my attention, my presence, be really close in to myself and feel how I'm feeling when I'm clinging or caught. And generally, if I'm clinging or caught in something, it's unpleasant. But one of the very interesting things that's unpleasant about it is not only the unpleasantness of it, but also my dislike of it, my judgment of it, my wanting to push it away, my embarrassment around it, all these attitudes I have towards it. And so to turn towards it, the felt sense, the inner feeling, the sensations in your body of the emotions, the feelings, the what goes on in your muscles when you cling. Sometimes you'll actually feel in your muscles that they're still holding tight. Not just in the mind, but your musculature as well. Or there are certain emotions that are deeply connected to the clinging. And you can feel different places in your body. And so you turn towards and really are close to it and get closer and closer. They need to get close. Be intimate. Many people in the West like to be intimate. So to be intimate, be real intimate with what's difficult for you. Be intimate with your bad feelings, how you're feeling. Go towards it. And as you get closer and closer to it, one of the things that will fall away, hopefully, but one of the things that will fall away is your dislike of it, your resistance to it, your aversion to it, your judgments of it. Or sometimes people love their clinging. And if you get really close to it, then your love and your desire for it will also fall away. Because loving it and hating it is to be removed from it. There's all this way of being separate that happens when we cling, layers of separation. So to turn towards it. And so I find that notion very helpful, that you have turned towards, feel what I'm feeling, and be still. Be really still. Allow it to be there. Maybe kind of like, you know, holding a bird in your hand, open hand, very gentle, very soft, and just hold it. You know, you can't squeeze tight, and you don't kind of let your hands fall open, but you offer a kind of presence and attention that's respectful and kind, but close and attentive to what's there. So generally when people cling or hold on, they don't feel so good, and so there's a resistance to being present for that. And so it's counterintuitive to move into it, but to move into it with care and tenderness is a very important learning as we learn to do this mindfulness thing. And so as we get closer and more tender and more present, then our reaction to it begins falling away. And so then it's, you know, you just feel lousy, and it's just lousy. as opposed to feeling lousy and hating it. Which would you rather have? You like it complicated, so multi-course meal, so you have lousy, you hate it, and you're embarrassed for it, and then you try to compensate for it. You know, you can get more very elaborate meals of, or you can have a very simple life, very simple meal, just feel the lousiness in and of itself. But actually, I think it just feels a lot better just to feel it, be close. And then sometimes you want to take your time. There's sometimes, I think when people don't feel good, there's often a hurry to fix it, to get better, to feel it's a personal flaw that you should be feeling bad, a personal flaw that you're clinging. Heaven forbid that you're a Buddhist and clinging. Don't come to IMC and admit it to anyone. You know, only come here when you can be relaxed and open. So, but to turn towards and admit it, feel it, be present for it, be intimate, and give yourself, be still, the idea of being still with it. And the poem I'll read that kind of represents this being still is one of patience, to allow something to happen, to allow something to unfold. Maybe you don't know what's supposed to happen to your clinging. Maybe you don't know what's supposed to happen to your sorrow or your grief or your greed or your desire or your disappointment, whatever it might be. Maybe, who knows, maybe, you know, it's a little bit of a conceit to think you know what's supposed to happen. It's supposed to go away or do something. So anyway, there's this poem by Ikkyu, Japanese monk poet. He wrote, "Break open a cherry tree and there are no flowers. But the spring breeze brings forth myriad blossoms." So imagine yourself in a hurry to have the cherry blossoms at springtime. So you get out your axe and you start hacking at the cherry tree to get those things to pop out faster. It doesn't work, right? But you have to be patient. You have to allow nature to take its course, the spring breeze. So sometimes that works for our inner life as well, our psychological life. If you learn the art of holding it in awareness, being close to it, but not reactive to it, close to it and not being for or against it, just close, get closer to it and closer to it and feel it. Let all the reactions fall away. Just feel lousy or whatever you're feeling. Just feel it, simple, and be patient. Then the spring breeze of that attention might allow something to mature and unfold. And I can't tell you how many times I've done this, I find it every time beautiful when there is a letting go, but I'm not the one who's let go. And, you know, many times I've been tried to engineer my letting go. You know, finally, I need to let go, you know, that's what I'm supposed to do here, that's the task. I know I'm clinging, and there's the clinging, and, you know, I'm supposed to be a good yogi and let go and be happy ever after. And you know, there's all this conceit, all this self that's built into it. It's more of this kind of separation, pulling back, not being close. But to go in there, just feel it and be present, be very attentive, very still, aware, and then let it, see what happens, and then it just dissolves or fades away or morphs or changes into something else. Who knows what it's going to be? So that's one whole process that I'm very fond of. Sometimes, though, it can be more involved. Sometimes you can get close to it and you can see what you're holding on to. Sometimes you can, by being close and attentive and mindful to your belief systems, you can see, oh, that's why I'm holding on to a certain self-identity that I thought was important. It was important to be seen as a person who's competent or beautiful or smart or whatever. And you see that that's what you were believing. So you go, now that I see that I believe that, I don't know if I believe it anymore. As long as I didn't see it, the belief I believed. But now that I really see it, you know, maybe I don't have to believe it anymore. And then sometimes people can just let go. Sometimes it's easy, and sometimes it's not. Sometimes it takes a lot of time and effort to get to know oneself better, to let go. Sometimes there is wrestling. Sometimes the process of letting go is not peaceful. Sometimes we know we need to let go, We can see how we're holding on to something. We're afraid to let go because just the other side of letting go is insecure, is unknown, and there's fear. Sometimes it's, you know, it's a wrestling with our demons to let go, you know, to sort of deal with what we're holding on to and clinging. When after I was practicing Buddhism for, I've been practicing pretty seriously for about 3 years. Seriously meaning I was living in as a monk in a monastery for almost 3 years. I don't know how serious I was, but I mean, conventionally it looks like that, you know, you go and live in a monastery. And but I, at some point I came to this edge where I could see what I have to let go of is my clinging to myself, my self-clinging, clinging to my identity and needing to be something in someone, in other people's eyes. And I couldn't let go because I was afraid. You know, I just, you know, I could see what I had to do. It's like I could, like being at the edge of a cliff or something. I knew I had to take that step, but I wasn't going to. And then a variety of things then helped that. One was, in this particular case, I then went to Asia to practice, and I decided I'd make crossing the international date line my ritual to let go. And so I had this idea, okay. And I paid attention to the clock or whatever, and kind of, and I don't know if it helped, but I had this idea I needed a ritual. But then what helped the most was this process I described earlier of turning towards and into the place of fear, the place of holding, the place of attachment, the place where the mind was churning, wanting to be seen, yearning to be seen, yearning to get something from other people, and being present and feeling it, being with it. And then letting it drop into it deeper and deeper, get closer until it dropped away by itself. So that's one whole process, the process of turning towards our clinging. And I think it's counterintuitive because it doesn't feel good in a variety of ways. It's kind of sometimes seen as a problem. But I think a really wise approach is this leaning towards, going into being present. And then there's a variety of things you can do there. Now, the whole other side that I want to talk about tonight is was inspired by many years ago when by a teacher who said something like, the way I like to say it now is, if you have to let go, you've already missed the boat. If you have to let go, you've already sacrificed your peace. If you have to let go, you're already separate from your what's going on. And if all you're supposed to do is to always let go, you haven't really gone very deep into yourself. You haven't really learned yourself. Because the idea, hopefully, is to come to a time and place where you don't pick up, where you don't cling, where you don't contract. And so someone says something to you. Your mother wears army boots. Isn't that what they say in America? Isn't that what, in the cartoons or something? Yeah, that's right. The Canadian says yes. and so that time comes when someone says that, and it goes right through your mind, right through your consciousness, your awareness. And it doesn't stick anywhere. You don't pick up, you don't react to it. There's no need to let go of your clinging to it because you didn't do anything with it, just words that travel through. And so there comes a time, the process of letting go is leading to a mind, to a heart or a mind or awareness, which is peaceful, which is beautifully still, which is clear, which is open, which is spacious, which is cool. There's many ways people talk about this. Very satisfying, warm, intimate, at peace is my favorite, heart at peace. Once you've let go deep enough and well enough to experience the other side of that, the peace at the other side of it, then the instruction is lean towards that. get to know that. Be intimate with that. Go into that. And all the capacity you've learned to be present for what's difficult in your life will develop a capacity to be present for what's beautiful. And so then turn towards and feel the peace. Feel what that's like. Get to know that. Get to know it so it becomes kind of a visceral memory or something that you've become familiar with. So you can start recognizing it when it's there in the background of your day. So you're going around doing your activity and you recognize, oh, there's a stillness there. I'm kind of, you know, if I just stop kind of being so preoccupied with doing my taxes, then, you know, there's a stillness that's kind of just kind of close by. Or there's a peace, or there's a spaciousness, or an openness, or a clarity that's there, or a subtleness. And to recognize that becomes something that supports us and creates a different context for how we go through our lives, because then we're supported by something that is beautiful and present for us. So the idea of when you cling, you've already missed the boat, means that you missed the boat of staying in touch with your peace. And there's a practice in staying in touch with it, staying with it, recognizing and being with it. There's an art to learning to appreciate that state of mind as being more valuable than your preoccupations, your greeds, your desires, your aversions, your pettiness, or whatever. And so to recognize what that's like so that you come to it, so that when something occurs, it doesn't ruffle you. One of the Buddhist ideas of this mind, the peaceful mind, whatever, still mind, I call it, is the Buddhist, classic Buddhist terminology is the unmoving mind. It doesn't move. And not that it's frozen, but rather it's just so open that there's no ruffles, there's no agitation, there's no ripples. Things occur, and it doesn't affect us negatively in any kind of way at all. So what does it take to have that? What is it, or say it differently, if you've let go to some degree and have experienced some degree of peace as a result, the other side of letting go, one of the very interesting ways of practicing then is to notice what you're willing to give up your peace for. Because chances are you'll give it up. You know, I've given up my peace just so that I could beat the red light driving. You know, what's more important? It's you know, get to give you a ridiculous example, how easy it is, how quick it is, to give up. Let alone, you know, you can probably have lots of examples of things can seem much, much, much more important and monumental things for which you have absolute right to cling. Or it just seems like really a noble cause to cling for. And so we give up our peace. But to question and doubt, why are we willing to give up our peace? Is it really worth it? Is a very interesting exploration to have that debate and that exploration with yourself. What are you willing to give up your peace for? What do you sacrifice it for? And is it worth it? So as I practice my Buddhism, as I practice my life, I see my own practice sometimes swings between these two approaches in a very general way. Sometimes I cling, and what I do is I turn towards it and practice with it. And sometimes my practice is not about that, but my practice or my life, the way I am, is more has to do with the peace or the open mind or the unmoving mind or the clear mind or whatever language is. And the practice is to stay with that, live with that, and allow the experience of life, what goes on, to occur around me, through me, with me, as if I'm an open window or an open door, and things can just go right through. And that doesn't make me, I hope, aloof or indifferent or less human, I think it makes me more human. At least I feel that there's a greater intimacy with myself and with life and with others, the more of it the door is open. And in fact, when it's so open, then I'm not standing in the doorway. That's the best. So I'll end with this poem by Li Po, a Chinese poet. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. So we have about 15 minutes, and so this is your chance if you'd like to ask any questions about that, or specific questions around the practice of it, or if you want to give, you know, offer something, you're welcome to do so. Yeah, where's the other mic?
Okay. Thank you. What kind of activity is in Zen or Buddhism when you're dealing with like a scientific problem? You're clinging into solving a scientific problem. How do you see it in Zen practice? What kind of clinging is that?
What kind?
Yeah, well, what is it? You are striving to solve a problem, for example.
Striving to solve a problem, scientific problem, doesn't have to involve clinging, but it can involve clinging. And clinging takes many different forms. Sometimes the clinging has to do with pleasure, clinging to pleasure. The pleasure, sometimes it has to do with success and all the associations success has. If I can solve this problem, I'll get the Nobel Prize, my colleagues will like me more, or I'll get a promotion. So there's clinging to some idea that connected to the success. Sometimes it has to do with, clinging to a personal capacity. You know, I have to prove myself, I'm the one who has to solve this. There's many things that we can cling to when we're trying to solve a problem. But it's possible also to strive. It's possible to put a lot of effort into something without there being clinging.
So the problem is when judgment comes in, that how we are being, I don't know how to word it, but when we are like Nobel Prize, how we are being perceived from outside.
That's one thing people cling to, yes. And they contract around. How they're perceived, how they think they're being perceived, and some people will do their activities, and the activity that they're involved in the activity, but while they're doing it, they're very concerned about how they're seen doing it, and the expectation of what it's going to do for the reputation, and that's where the clinging is.
So Buddhism is any kind of activity which involves judgment.
It depends what you mean by judgment, but
you always talk about a neutral state of mind, and not you. I'm really, that's the whole thing. You neutralize mind, and when you're not neutralizing, there is a polarization, which is judgment. Probably it comes from judgment.
It can be.
So I just want to find out where boundaries are here.
The boundaries. The judgment is an interesting word because I think evaluating things, being discerning is important. So just recognize the difference between things, recognize when you're clinging, when you're not. And judging whether, you know, having a simple judgment like, you know, it's not, you know, if I continue clinging so much, I'm going to get a heart attack. You know, if I'm clinging so much, you know, I'm certainly going to get a headache. And that's it's a kind of a judgment call. But but usually when in English, when people use the word judgment in a pejorative, negative term, way, then judge is being judgmental is adding, saying it's good or it's bad. And there's a kind of a rejection of something, a hate of it or pushing it away, aversion of it, or a clinging and holding, desiring of it. And that movement of contracting and pushing away in the mind, or contracting and holding on, that's not necessary.
So you use the word discern versus judgment. So
I like the word discerned. Evaluate, discern.
Okay.
And we have to, you know, and so that's an important part of I think, of a mature, good life is to be discerning and wise and evaluate what's going on, to be able to distinguish between what's useful and not useful.
Thank you.
So I saw a hand over here. In the back.
Let's see. This is, again, sort of like a householder issue. And I usually consider that householder also equates to what one does in business or, as the gentleman was talking about, science. You know, where you're striving for some particular effect, and you know, you start to have failure, or at least you perceive failure, and you get angry at your fellow workers or scientists, and then you become less productive. You're not, the anger is spread out among your fellow workers, especially if you're the boss. This leads to even a more catastrophic situation in terms of failing at the program or project.
Right.
You know, I'm finding that what you were saying, I have a little taste for that, which is that I'm attempting, you know, to recognize that I've already over catastrophized the issue, and you know, all these sorts of things can happen while you attempt to change or modify something to move forward in the project. I mean, it's not always, you're not always looking for credit or you're just trying to be ineffective in your job.
Yeah, so clinging,
yeah.
Clinging is being trapped by desire.
Yeah.
There's not. There's many desires to be had. You can desire at work to success, to make a product, to do have the company go a certain way.
Yeah.
And desire is not the problem. The desire is when we're trapped by it. The problem is when we're trapped by the desire, and in the vice of the desire, when there's compulsion, and that's when if there's desire and there's failure at our task, then there doesn't have to be any problem necessarily with. Yeah, but it's a. But if we're trapped by the desire, there's expectation, and an insistence, then we can get frustrated.
Yes.
To understand the difference between having, to understand the difference, be discerning, the difference between having a desire, and that compulsion, the insistence that goes with the desire, is a very important distinction to make.
Yeah.
And, you know, you described this scenario that started somewhat simply and grew and to become catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the function of meditation is to come back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so to simplify, at least try to simplify, try to relax, let go, so we can get back close to the beginning where it all starts. Because many times people are living in the catastrophe zone. But if you're living too much, you know, it's gotten so complicated. Sometimes it's hard to sort it out. But if at least the mind can go sit and meditate for an hour and get and relax and let go of all the thoughts and stories and ideas and get quiet, sometimes you can get back down to the source, the original point where the clinging is.
And probably make the better decisions.
Probably much better.
Yep.
And, you know, the gentleman here talked about, you know, clinging in science. I mean, there's a fair number of great scientific discoveries that happened when the scientists stopped obsessing. You know, they were very actively involved. It was an important part of the process. But then they went for a walk or took a shower or did something and weren't thinking about it. And then, there it was, the answer. So I saw one more hand here, and then probably we should stop. Or maybe we should have a woman, because all these guys.
Well, something happened this morning where I was sitting very peacefully, and then my husband erupted in my office and said something that was that I felt as very reactive. And, you know, I try to stay cool and very calm, and outwardly, I seemed very calm and not reacting to him. But then I found myself for the day getting really, really angry. And I was sitting, you know, earlier, and I just felt like this really hot coal, you know. And then as I was sitting with it, I realized that what really bugged me was the clinging to the idea of peace.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I just couldn't stand that he disrupted my peace. But after realizing that, it was really kind of a relief, because I felt that, well, I don't have to cling to the idea of peace. I mean, that's kind of unreasonable. So.
Yeah, it destroys the peace. Someone wants to find enlightenment as being interruptible. Meaning that, you know, you guess something can happen that's unexpected and the mind doesn't get agitated or caught by it. So something about, you know, of course, this is how it works in life, that someone does something and upsets us. And I think that being calm is often better than being angry. So it's kind of nice to be calm, but you have to be wise about being calm. You don't want to pretend that you're calmer than you actually are, or pretend that you're less reactive than you are. So what I think, you know, but it's good to be calm and not, you know, lash out. But to be honest, you'd say to maybe your husband, you'd say calmly, relaxed way, and say, "I'm really pissed off." You know, be honest about what's going on, but, you know, try to do it, you know, with a way that doesn't. And I've done that sometimes, you know, try to find the language to try to stay calm and centered. And sometimes it's a little bit of struggle to do it, but not to deny how I'm feeling, but then in that space of calm to find a wise way to let people know, to inform people what's happening for me inside. You know, I'm in, you know, wow, you know. I was doing my thing peacefully. It was important for me. I finally had some alone time. You burst in and said this thing to me. And now, maybe saying I'm pissed off maybe is not the wisest thing, but you could start the conversation by saying, but now I'm in turmoil. They say I'm in turmoil. Most people say, what? When's the last time I heard someone say they were in turmoil? And so it gets their attention. And, you know, that's necessarily, like, you're not necessarily attacking them. In turmoil, you know, and so then maybe you can begin a conversation about what happened. And
well, I actually did say something like that. Uh-huh. But I think the source of distress was more that I did not realize the clinging.
Oh, yeah.
What I was clinging to.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just like this light that just went on when I realized that that's what was really disrupting. Yeah. It was not what he was upset about or what, but it was that he had disrupted the.
I love that. So I think anybody who practices a path of peace sooner or later is going to have to learn to overcome their attachment to the peace. and let it unfold as it wishes. So, it's at 9 o'clock. So, maybe later, if you want to come up and ask me, you're welcome to do that. But I think we should stop. It's 9 o'clock. So, thank you all very much.